Welcome back to Creative Therapy Umbrella. This is a place where we talk about all different types of creative arts therapies, expressive therapies, and creative approaches to therapy. Thank you guys so much for supporting my self-care need last week and being so gracious when I wasn't able to put out an episode because I had laryngitis. My voice is so much better this week, and that self-care really made a difference of taking that time off to rest. On today's episode, I get to talk with Chris Wojak, who is not only one of my good friends who I went to graduate school with, but he is also currently here in Denver as well, and him and I are doing some research together. So he is an incredibly fun person to talk with, so insightful when it comes to collaboration, when it comes to interdisciplinary treatment, such as combining mental health work with music therapy, and when talking about integrating spirituality into mental health work. This is a fantastic episode that is just chock full of great information, and Chris is always just a lot of fun to talk to. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and I will talk with you on the other side. All right, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I've been very excited for this interview to finally happen.
Yeah, I know. It's funny, been a long time coming.
Yes, yes. And it's funny that we actually live in the same city, but scheduling and life and research, everything just gets in the way sometimes.
Am I your first Denver guest?
No, actually, no. Bonnie Haupt was a Denver guest. And I feel like I had another one, but I think we did it through Zoom also.
Okay.
So right. I know. I would love to do more in-person interviews, but that takes a lot of time to set up the audio equipment and all that stuff. So
that's true.
Yeah. Zoom is easy. So, but for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about what you currently do?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Chris Wojak. I am a board certified music therapist and a licensed professional counselor in the state of Colorado. Right now, I'm sort of on my own in a private practice, or rather with a friend's practice. So I think I have probably the most eclectic caseload of my career. My youngest client is 6 and my oldest client is 60.
Wow.
And I really wear different hats on different days. So whatever day you catch me, I'm going to be doing something different. I do music therapy, play therapy. I use a lot of more, I guess you could say, traditional psychotherapy with adults. I do a lot of psychoeducation for the community. I'm going out to a school tomorrow to talk about screen time and child development. And we have an intern at our practice. And so we are trying to put together a mental health support group. So all different projects. And I'm doing some research with you.
Yes.
With the University of Rochester, looking at music therapy, songwriting, and cholesterol, of all things.
That sounds hilarious. I still laugh every time. Music therapy and cholesterol.
I know. Well, it's not quite what you think. It's more about motivation and determination. But these are patients with a rare cholesterol disorder.
Yes. And that, what's really exciting about that research is that, can you tell us a little bit about the conference that's coming up in the next couple months?
Oh, that's right. We're going to give a brief presentation of our research at the, International Association for Music and Medicine conference. And that is in Boston. Oh my gosh. When is it?
May
at the very end of May. Yeah. May 28th to 30th. So I think we're on, that Thursday, whatever that date ends up being, but yeah, that's a great time. I've been to one of their conferences before when it was, back when you and I were both in upstate New York,
mm-hmm.
and they had the IAMM conference in Toronto. And it's a really fun time because it's not just music therapists. It's like, you'll meet doctors and nurses, nurse practitioners, and medical research people who are using music. So you're going to meet people you wouldn't typically meet at a music therapy conference.
Which is really awesome. I love the niche of that it's this medical music kind of space too, where I would imagine anybody who is in like a hospital setting or even hospice and palliative care, that a conference like that is such a great supplemental conference to traditional music therapy conferences.
Yeah, and it's great in both directions. We get to advocate for our field and meet people who are interested in music therapy who might have access to resources we don't have access to, and we also get to learn from them, right? So who was the keynote? The year I went, the keynote was Norman Doidge. He wrote that book, The Brain That Changes Itself. So it's
wow.
You might see some big names.
That's awesome. That's super exciting. And Boston, that's always fun too. That it's
I love it.
Yeah, in fun places too, which is really great. Cool. And I will be sure to link that information for the conference itself in the show notes too, for anyone listening who hasn't looked at it before, because it's a really, really cool conference. For sure. So, Chris, you're very unique in that you are a music therapist, but you're also dual certified or dual licensed, kind of in a way, as a licensed professional counselor.
Right.
And that we're both in that boat because we went to Nazareth College of Rochester, which set us up to be able to get licensure, which many programs don't do that for music therapists.
Right.
But I think for you, it would be really cool if you could tell us. I know a lot of people, especially music therapists, are really interested in what was the catalyst that made you want to get your LPC? Because it's not required for us to practice, but what was kind of that driving force behind getting that?
You know, it was such a long and winding road. Even for me to get to music therapy was a long and winding road. So you and I both have graduate degrees in music therapy. Mm-hmm. And my undergrad was in music. And so even that, you know, like I took psychology courses. I think I was like one short of a psychology minor, and learned about music therapy my senior year of college. And these music therapists from NYU came and presented. So that was like my pivot point from music to music therapy. And then as a music therapist, it was a long and winding road to get to the population I ended up working with. You know, I went into music therapy thinking I want to work with the elderly, or I want to do some work in Alzheimer's and dementia care, and ended up really liking working with kids and working in special education. So kiddos with developmental disabilities. And then in my internship, I discovered that the kids I most enjoyed working with were the kids with the mental health issues. So oftentimes you might hear like dual diagnosis, or a lot of the kids in the school where I interned had experienced some kind of trauma in their past. And so there were, you know, the behavioral disorders as well, you know, you'd have those on their IEP. So I needed to learn more about that. And then when I moved here to Colorado, I learned that music therapists in some ways, well, we don't have state licensure in Colorado, so we should say that. I'm sure you've said it before. And yes. That's a barrier for how we can practice, right? We're more limited in how we can practice and who we can see. So there were two things. There was sort of like the interest in learning more, learning this skill set of mental health and mental health counseling, but also there was like the practical motivation of, you know, the agency where I was working really wanted me to be able to get paid for the work I do, like reimburse, you know, for insurance and for Medicaid. And the only way to do that for me feasibly was to be an LPC. So I looked at the coursework that I took at Nazareth College, and then I looked at the, you know, it's called KCREP. It's like this accrediting body that basically tries to standardize counseling programs to make sure everyone gets human development, everyone gets family therapy, everyone gets... So I looked at those, and I noticed that, you know, I was only missing a few courses. I submitted an application. I got a response eventually. And I got a list of courses I needed to take. I took those here in Denver, resubmitted the application with supervision hours, took a test called the NCE, took another test called the jurisprudence, and now after that long and winding road, I have my license as a mental health counselor.
It's awesome. And how I love listening to, in it's funny because I know you really well, but I had no idea that you were originally thinking Alzheimer's and that population. But how our experiences kind of fall into place, that we end up working in these places or in these settings that then we find of like, wow, oh, I really like this and I didn't expect it. And now I'm in this place where I can get this license and maybe I should, because I'm really liking working within the mental health community.
Totally. And we were quite lucky to have that education that we had. Music therapy, I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners are music therapists, but for those who are perhaps other kinds of therapists or other creative arts therapists, it's important to know just how diverse the field is. You know, for example, the music therapist who worked for me at the residential facility where I was for the last 4 years-ish, she graduated from a school that was very much like this kind of medical neurological model. And so for her to get an LPC would have required a second master's degree. Whereas for you and I, it requires supplemental coursework and potentially an internship. So it really all depends. You might go to a school that's very improvisational. You might go to a school that's very focused on guided imagery and music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny, as I've done this podcast and learned more about the creative arts field as a larger whole from music therapy and music therapy, you know, we were kind of the outliers of who could get licensure for the program that we went to at NAS. And you could get the LCAT if you were in New York, if you had a specific music therapy or creative arts therapy license, but in many other states where that's not there, you just don't get anything. But we were also housed in a department that was a creative arts therapy department. So we were taking classes alongside art therapists and people who were doing play therapy. And I don't think I realized it until now, but most other creative arts therapists outside of music therapy are all getting their LPC, their LMHC, like they're all going, they have a lot of programs that go to that licensure, whereas music therapists, we really don't have that. And I didn't really realize that until really a year ago, maybe.
And oftentimes they don't realize that either, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that it's different from, you know, for example, dance movement therapy or art therapy, where it's an additional credential that attaches to your LPC or your LMHC, but you know, we're autonomous, right? We're more like, maybe you could say more like occupational therapist, right? It's like its own credentialing body, its own organization, its own degree programs.
Yes. And I believe too, I almost don't want to say this out loud because I might be wrong, but if I am, then that means someone needs to write in and correct me and then I can talk to them about it and interview them. I think with art therapists, I think they're master's level entry, that to get your ATRBC, you have to have a master's.
Correct.
If it's, yeah. So
yeah, we're the only ones. We're the only ones.
I know. It's so crazy. So I was just talking with Betsy King, and I think it was number 24. Man. Yeah. A few episodes ago.
I miss Dr. King. She's
the best.
So good.
She's the best. If you haven't listened to it yet, go listen to her.
I will. I saw that you interviewed her. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's so great.
I think
she's
we talked for 3 hours, but our interview is an hour, but she's just the best. But yeah, she had, you know, we talked a lot about that too, of how that difference really, it can be really confusing when you're trying to advocate for your field too, especially if someone has come in contact with an art therapist before and they might be like, oh, music therapy is really similar in that it's a creative arts, but our specializations, our credentialing process is so different. So it can be really, really exhausting in that vein.
Definitely. We do a lot of educating. By the way, I just realized on the topic of music therapy, you're going to hear wind chimes in the background because there's wind chimes outside my house and they're blowing.
I love them. It is super windy today.
It is. Yep.
I took my dog out and she is a huge fan of the snow. She'll bury her head in the snow all day long, but she is petrified of the wind and will just stop and lay down. Yeah. It's hilarious.
I had a dog growing up that like was utterly unfazed by the wind. He would just go outside and stand, and then, like, the cold Rochester wind would just blow in his face, and he just wouldn't do anything about it. But other dogs hate it. So
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny what they like and don't like. Well, so on the topic of, you mentioned spending about 4 years working in a residential facility. Can you give us a little bit more detail of what that looked like as a music therapist, as you were getting your LPC? What did that role look like for you?
Yeah, so residential care is a setting, a congregate care setting, that's like a higher level of care than, for example, a school. And so the facility I worked at, we served children ages 5 to 13 with, like, behavioral or emotional disorders, most of whom who have experienced some kind of trauma or abuse or neglect in their lives. So a lot of really sad stories, a lot of kiddos who were removed from the home by, like, the Department of Human Services, waiting for foster placements, but also kiddos who, you know, came from out of state because, believe it or not, you know, some of our neighboring states didn't actually have facilities equipped at the level that this one was. So a great 4 years, about half of it, I was a music therapist only. And then the second half of my time there, I wore two hats, if that makes sense, or two umbrellas, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Well, how did that, I'm really curious about how that changed your work or how that changed your identity as a clinician, especially being in one place and having that change happen. That's really interesting.
Right. I got involved with a lot more paperwork for one. So as an LPC, I was a primary case holder, right? So for example, half of my caseload were clients that I was responsible for. I was their individual therapist, their family therapist, in many cases, and also responsible for case management. And then the other half of my caseload, I was just the adjunct music therapist. So clients would get referred to me from other therapists or from teachers. I would see them for music therapy. I'd write my note. You know, that was pretty much it. So it definitely impacted, you know, that, you know, the work is very different, right? Like, case management is an entirely different skill set. It would involve things like coordinating with an external case manager to make sure that these kids get some wraparound services as they leave our facility. It involved making sure that, you know, my clients were taken care of on the unit in the school. I would be coordinating with lots of different people because there were so many different players, you know, in the game or members of what we would call the therapeutic web. But it also impacted the clinical work, right? Because, you know, as an LPC, I had suddenly the freedom to use interventions that didn't involve music, right? Mm-hmm. Which I know you're interested in as well. And we've talked about this before, you know, as music therapists, sometimes it's like, okay, well, how do I make this musical?
Yeah. Like, I have this idea and I know what question I maybe should follow up, but is this musical enough? Are we doing it? Yeah. That's always
right. Am I doing enough
monologue.
Music?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And, you know, sometimes in music therapy sessions, the client will want to talk. And it's like, well, at what point, you know, at what point am I outside of my scope of practice?
Yes, so much. Oh, that's like the internal battle, so much.
So very liberating to not be bound by that and to really get to explore other modalities. I got really into, play therapy. I started TFCBT training. So that's trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy. Ooh. We had all of our clinicians at this facility do an internal family systems training, which is, some people get really into that. I don't know if you have much familiarity with that.
I don't. I think I've heard of it before. Maybe you've mentioned it before, but I don't really know too much about it at all.
It's like parts work. Like you sort of imagine the psyche as like a constellation of parts that some of them have like different wounds and they can talk to each other. And they're like orbiting around the self.
Wow.
So for example, you know, if a client comes to you with some ambivalence, it's really helpful for those situations where a client says, oh, you know, I don't know if I want to stay at this job or leave this job. Well, it sounds like there's a part of you that wants to try something different. There's a part of you that maybe that's afraid of what would happen if you left. Like, yeah, You know, and then you can do these kind of, what would that part say to the other part kind of intervention.
So, ooh, that's so fun.
Got into that, got into acceptance and commitment therapy, mm-hmm. and some different family therapy modalities like EFT or the Gottman method. I worked with so many different people at this facility. I think I can name it. I don't have any problem with that. It was called Mount mm-hmm. St. Vincent Home right here in Denver, Colorado. And our team, you know, it was a really eclectic team. We had, you know, LPCs like myself and social workers, and we had an LMFT, so that'd be a licensed marriage and family therapist. So I think that, I mean, the great thing there is like you pick up from other people, right? I mean, you know, you know about this too at your own agency, mm-hmm. where it's like you work with people that, you know, maybe you work with someone who's really jazzed about like this modality, and like you get to pick their brain a little bit.
Yes. Yes, totally. And that's what I love working within a multidisciplinary team, is to be able to get that, just be able to reach out to somebody and be like, hey, can you tell me more about, you know, acceptance and commitment therapy? I've only heard about it. And then you've got all these, like everyone has their own kind of, I guess, specialization of those things, of what they get into. And I love just taking, you know, trying to take from them and give back to them. And that whole process is amazing.
I guess that is kind of the whole point of the podcast, isn't it?
It is. it's funny because I was just thinking about this yesterday. I was like, huh, how did this, like, I know I wanted to do it, but I never really thought about why so much of like, why do I really like doing this? And I think it goes back to NAS, as I've always, and you know, from, you know, being there too, is it's, we've always had an education revolving around collaboration, co-treating, you know, multidisciplinary treatment. So I think it's just like foundation. It feels like a foundation, but not everybody gets that, which is a bummer.
Yeah. And, I miss it. I still yeah. work with a team, but it's, you know, in my capacity right now as a contractor in private practice, it's less directly collaborative than yes. my work has been. One more thing about the residential facility that yeah. you know your listeners might be interested in. So it was eclectic. We each had our own, you know, skill set or our own modalities. A lot of my colleagues were graduates of Naropa University, so their practice was very much based in like contemplative work or mindfulness. But on top of everything was like the agency's like grand philosophy of treatment. And the cool thing about working there was we all got trained in that. And that was called NMT. And that's going to really throw off your music therapy listeners, because it's not NMT. It's not neurologic music therapy. It's a different NMT. Mm-hmm. It's called the Neurosequential Model of Therapeutics, which is a mouthful. I guess that's why they abbreviate it.
Oh, and everybody loves acronyms, man. Everybody loves acronyms.
I know. There's so many of them. Yeah. So NMT came out of the work of Dr. Bruce Perry, who I think, you know, a lot of people in trauma work are familiar with.
Yes.
And the nice thing about that model is that it was really supportive of the creative arts, because in child trauma, the whole idea is that early developmental disruptions impact brain development. Mm-hmm. And more traditional insight-oriented talk therapy is very, you know, it requires a lot of cognitive capacity, we'll say, to sit and talk.
Yes, yes.
But any kiddo, but especially a kiddo who's had some intense experiences early in life is not going to be able to benefit too much from that kind of therapy right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. So can you give us a picture of what that would look like, the combination of a creative arts, if it's music therapy, and the neurosequential model? What do those things look like when they're kind of smashed together?
Yeah, the way like I would conceptualize it is music therapy is like a part. Mm-hmm. So all of the kids would get this really comprehensive assessment called a brain map, where we are going to score different functional areas of the brain and see which areas are like age typical and which areas are underdeveloped. And I think a lot of people may have seen this, but it kind of looks like an upside down triangle. And it's like the lower part is like the lower brain, the brainstem. Mm-hmm. And then you have the limbic area in the middle. And then at the top for 10 points, what's the top part of the brain, Kate?
Oh, no. I'm completely blanking.
The most developed would be the neocortex.
The cortex? Yeah, oh, thank God. Oh, God. Yeah. I won't edit that out, although I'm tempted.
No, but you know, it's instructive, and I'll tell you why. It's because you needed that part to answer that question, but you might have gotten a little stressed when I asked you, and that's the first part to shut down.
Exactly what I was meant. That totally was my idea. No, I was actually distracted because I was writing the triangle down, and I was like, ooh, brain, limbic, I like this upside-down triangle idea.
Oh, it's so useful. Yeah, it's very useful.
Yes.
Awesome. So music therapy. So at least the way that Dr. Perry... the way that he talks about music therapy, and by the way, it is nice that he talks about music therapy. I mean, it's always good to have, like we said, advocates in the field who are music therapists themselves. He usually places it as an intervention that targets the lower areas of the brain. Mm-hmm. And there's good reason for that, because music experiences, especially, you know, certain music experiences, like I'm thinking of like a lot of percussion interventions. Mm-hmm. They, you know, everything requires the cortex. We're human beings, like we use our whole brains. But boy, those are experiences that really target the lower brain areas where all of that sensory input first enters. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I presented a bit on music therapy and child trauma, and I was drawing from some really interesting research that early music education actually alters the brain stem. Like the auditory parts of the brain stem, which is the least plastic part of the brain, right? So like if, you know, you're in your 20s and you have a brain injury, you can get other parts of the cortex to make up for the parts of the cortex that have been damaged. That's really flexible. It's really plastic. But those lower brain areas are a lot more set in stone. So it's really cool to think that music has this unique ability to potentially alter the lower brain areas. And that's why it fits really well with the NMT framework. So if a kiddo, so here's the thing, I would get all the most dysregulated kiddos for music therapy. If there's a kid that wasn't responding to anything else, they'd be like, oh, use music therapy, alter the brainstem.
Just go in and fix this.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Does that make sense, kind of?
It does. It makes a lot of sense. It's fascinating. I had no idea about how the brainstem like can be altered like that. And then as you're saying this too, I remember reading this book from years ago when I was reading a lot of ethnomusicology kind of stuff about and brain historical brain stuff and, you know, how music may have affected that. And I think this was, I think it was a book called The Singing Neanderthals. Have you ever heard of that book?
Yeah, you may have told me about it.
Okay.
It sounds really fascinating.
Oh, it's super fascinating. But what the whole premise of that was, it talked about, and I guess it's a theory based that the utilization of drums for different things, for say, if it's especially something that involves survival, like war, it initially makes you want to move and like move, go into a survival space because it activates the brainstem. So it like, it is a survival, it goes right to like survival mode, I guess, which is the same kind of thing. It's going just like right to that area. And it's just that we used to use it in one way and maybe now we can use it in a different way, I guess, if that makes sense.
Oh, that, absolutely. Thank you for mentioning ethnomusicology. Totally. Actually, one other really cool aspect of the neurosequential model is exactly that. You know, Dr. Perry talks about how every non-Western culture, every indigenous culture has healing rituals around traumatic events that typically involve movement, music, art, and meaning making.
Oh, I love that.
But, you know, we kind of don't have that. We've kind of lost that in the West, in our modern age. We have other ways of dealing with trauma that are less somatic. And so, it makes perfect sense. If like our ancestors had percussion and movement rituals that were associated with like rites of passage or healing from trauma, you know, these are like deeply ingrained human experiences. So yeah, absolutely. That's yet another reason to think that music therapy would be helpful in helping people heal from traumatic events, particularly children.
Yes. Oh, that's fascinating. I need to go take that training like now, like yesterday.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you've read the book, I think, right? The Boy Who Was Racist.
Oh gosh, that's like it makes me want to cry and like jump up and down at the same time. It's such an amazingly sad, beautiful book. I love it.
It's really good, and there's some videos on YouTube as well. A lot of like lectures.
I didn't
Bruce
know
Perry
that.
Stuff.
Yeah. I'm gonna check some of those out. That's fascinating. And so it's amazing how, even within Bruce Perry, how multidisciplinary that is of, you know, the somatic experiences, bringing it to somatics of, you know, what there's the other book. I'm losing the title. Cortex.
The body.
Come on, Cortex. Yeah.
Body Keeps the Score.
Yes. That one. I it's funny that we're moving. I think we're moving back to a space like that where we've probably historically were, or in other cultures they still value that, but it's funny that we're kind of moving back to that now of, oh, maybe we do need to involve the body into these experiences.
I had one client who he only started to make progress after I referred him for massage therapy. 11-year-old kid with trauma in his past.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's all connected, you know. You can't just, you know, we're not just like these spirits, you know, we have bodies. We need to use the body in psychotherapy.
Yes, so much. So that's why I love talking with dance and movement therapists of hearing.
Yes. Oh,
how,
yes.
Oh, the ideas of how, you know, to embody different things. And sometimes that's embodying what an animal might do, or, you know, just all these different ideas of getting your body really involved, getting in touch with it so much more.
I think so. Listen to this. My supervisor for a while was a dance movement therapist, and she always took issue with, you know, those kind of like feeling charts that therapists, especially us therapists who work with kids, will often print out.
Yep. Red,
you know,
blue,
like a chart,
red,
or like little pictures, like smiley faces, or maybe like photographs of facial expressions. And it's like happy, sad, mad, glad. She took issue with the fact that they're always from the neck up.
That's so true.
You never see a feeling chart that's like a whole body. Like for fear, they could be in fetal position, or for happy, you can see them with arms outstretched or something. It's always just the face.
That is so, I've never even thought about that, but what a like simple, but like earthquake type of, concept that, you know. And it's funny too, because I feel like I do this all the time talking with kids of like, oh, where do you feel that feeling? And it's, you know, oh, I feel it in my tummy, or I feel this one in my feet. And, you know, like that we're not visually representing that is, that's such a disservice. Oh, I have one in my room and I am changing it today.
Oh, I mean, you know, there's a time and a place for both, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's an interesting thought for sure.
It really is. It really, really is.
I just changed the way Kate's gonna practice using feeling charts. Yeah,
it's and I will make sure to tell the whole agency also. We need to try this, guys. We need to try it.
Oh, no.
Well, speaking of all this like collaboration between all these different arts, what has your experience been like collaborating with others who are maybe outside of the creative arts or just who are in adjacent fields? What has that experience been like for you so far?
Well, I'll answer that by telling you perhaps the most interesting recent collaboration that I've had.
Yes, that would be wonderful.
So my current, I currently work at a practice called Mount Tabor Counseling. Mm-hmm. And I have gotten to collaborate with its founder, my friend, who is a Eastern Catholic deacon. And so he is a psychotherapist. He's an LPC like me. Mm-hmm. But he's also trained in spiritual direction and sort of like pastoral counseling. And so for him, collaboration involves like, or with him, I should say, integrating not only mind-body, but also spiritual practices into psychotherapy, which is just like a whole another level.
Yeah.
So for example, drawing on a lot of really fascinating links between ancient spiritual practices and modern psychotherapy. He's a big fan of that. So for example, like, I mean, here's one, you know, there's a lot of research now, obviously consult your doctor, but there's a lot of research now coming out about like the mental health benefits of diet and fasting. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, so my friend, Deacon Basil is his name, you know, he'll say, oh, you know, you look at, you know, some of the writings of these ancient desert monks who will recommend fasting literally as like a mental health intervention mm-hmm. for like certain anxieties or preoccupations. Also, you know, now there's so much interesting research on meditation and prayer. Mm-hmm. So those are like really, that's just a whole nother level of collaboration. I've also had some experiences recently where I've collaborated in the session, like at the same time, dual, you know, we've both been joint co-therapists with an LMFT.
Okay, yeah.
And that's really cool because I've run into these situations, Kate, where I work with a client, like a, say a teenager, mm-hmm. the parents want to get involved and sometimes it gets a little precarious where it's like, okay, I'm allied with the kid, but I need to ally with the parents and I need to do interventions with the kid and interventions with the parents. And oftentimes it's easier in that case to refer out and say, okay, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to work one-on-one with your son. And then we're going to work all together with our marriage and family therapist. And so we had like a kind of like a pivot session where we were all in the room together.
Yeah. That's amazing. I love the name pivot session also. That's a really great way to explain it. And I think that's one of the hardest things too, is like that allied relationship of then, you know, making sure that you're supporting your client, number one, but then you also have to incorporate parents and you want to support parents who want to be involved too. Yeah. And then to be able to do that with somebody like a marriage and family therapist who's so specialized in that, those dynamics, it's so helpful.
Yeah. It's always cool to see how people, I mean, oftentimes we only ever hear about how our colleagues practice, but it's always cool to see it in the room, in the moment.
Yes.
It's not common for us, you know, I know we're all like, you know, trying to schedule our own schedules and, you know, try to bill and get everything done. But if you can just, for anyone listening, if you get a chance to do a co-treat session, it's just so fun.
So much learning. So I actually just took a poll on for some of my followers on Instagram of, is it more helpful to get information about co-treating itself or resources from other therapists to support you? And it was 50-50, which doesn't always happen. I know. So I was like, wow, it's really both of those things. I think it's like that spending that time in the session is so invaluable. Like it's so valuable. It's like, you can't get that from just getting a resource, you know, that experience of being in the moment and seeing the dynamic changes and having the back and forth, especially when you get to do it with somebody frequently, you know, and then you really kind of like get gelled together. But the resources too, like, you know, we don't all have the ability to co-treat with whoever it is we need to co-treat with. So having some of those, that independence with resources. But yeah, that's I'm so fascinated with the spirituality piece. Sounds so, so cool. And something that I haven't really heard a lot of people talk about, the blending of those two worlds, but it's something that comes up in therapy all the time.
Sure. Well, you've worked with end of life issues, right?
Yes. And that's where I feel like 3 years ago, I would probably be like, huh, I don't really hear about spirituality too much. But now it's something that's like, it's daily. It's a daily thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes. End of life. Right now I have a supervisee who's getting her hours for her LPC and mm-hmm. she interned in hospice. Mm-hmm. And oh my gosh. I mean, her stories, you know, we've talked about this before, Kate, where, you know, sometimes I have a little bit of like a skeptic's personality, you know?
Yes.
Like, oh, show me the proof. Huh? You know?
Where's the evidence?
Where's the evidence? Eh? But her stories are just really incredible. I mean, people have had such profound experiences and have had like visitations from relatives and dreams and visions of relatives in the afterlife that just really make you wonder, you wonder. So yeah, that's, and you know, we, at Mount Tabor, we try to have like a kind of like a grand rounds, you know, we do like a case consult once a month where we all get together and share cases. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good, opportunity. Cause you know, it's like we each wear our respective hats. Like I'll share, you know, here's the trauma-informed take on that. And then Deacon Basil can share the, you know, here's the, I mean, it's going to sound really fancy and pretentious, but here's the Eastern Neptic psychotherapeutic take on that.
Awesome.
But absolutely. I mean, this stuff comes up all the time. And, you know, oftentimes clients will seek out therapists who share their worldview. I mean, we know this from the research as well. For example, you know, any therapist working in sort of a particular cultural milieu or community, for example, like I know a lot of people in the LGBT community would want a therapist who's familiar with LGBT issues and LGBT advocacy. Similar thing holds for people of faith. Oftentimes, people who have a particular faith background will want a therapist who either shares that or is familiar enough with it to be conversant in it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. Because, and I think too of, this reminds me of, especially in palliative care, when it's almost even with like, I think that like about that with like someone who has familiarity with medical experiences or whatever, because it's like when you get a client who has, say they have muscular dystrophy, the parent doesn't want to have to explain it for the thousandth time.
No.
The therapist, you know, it's like, this is what, you know, it's like you're almost already have the foundation. It's like, okay, you understand me. You understand where I'm coming from. Like, I don't have to explain this to you. Like, it builds that level of trust too, where then you can move on and kind of like move to the meat quicker, I guess, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, you'll appreciate this. I recently had a client referred to me. Mom wants her kiddo to get some counseling and he has sensory processing disorder. Oh my gosh, the look on her face when I knew what sensory processing disorder was. It's like, oh, I'm a music therapist. I've worked a lot with sensory processing disorder.
It's like, oh my gosh.
Because she was getting ready to explain it for the thousandth time. And
exactly.
It was a huge relief to her.
It is. And I feel like too, you know, how traumatic also to have to explain over and over and over again. And I always feel that way, especially with children who have life-limiting illnesses and the parent or the child, depending how old they are expected to over and over again tell what that is, what it means, what is the prognosis, you know, like how re-traumatizing. Whereas if you can just come in and you have that understanding, it's like, okay, no, I got you. I get you. Let's do this. You know, like we don't even have to go there yet, you know?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I love that with the spirituality piece of it's that a part of that multiculturalism of what's important to somebody and how to find somebody else who can support that.
Yeah, definitely. And then getting to sort of be on the cutting edge, right, of psychotherapy and hearing my colleagues talk about like research that, you know, is like right at the forefront of integrating religious practice and psychotherapy. I mean, it seems to me that the field has sort of been moving in this direction in some ways, at least with the mindfulness movement. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, other developments with spiritual practice and how that can affect our mental health. I mean, there's a lot of fascinating research on, you know, for example, one thing, you know, we talk about both like in the NMT framework, but just more generally is community and relationship, right? And like, I often would recommend that to families whose kiddos I was working with in residential care. I'd say, well, tell me about your community. And if you don't have one, let's find you one. Now, here's an area where, you know, people of faith, you can absolutely capitalize on that with your clients and say, well, how can we get you more plugged into your community of faith where you find meaning? And build those relationships with people that are like long lasting that you can rely on.
Yes. That is so, and that's such an important part of that too. I think with spirituality, faith, if there is community around that, how do you build that support system and build those resiliencies outside of the session as well to keep growing in the session?
Yeah, I think that's really important, right? Is it like we, especially as an LPC, my thinking on this really started to shift because it's not just like the 1 hour a week where the work happens, right? But it's the client's entire life. And in that hour a week, you can use that time in different ways. But one of the ways clients can use that therapy time is figuring out, okay, what am I going to change in my day to day or my week to week Am I going to commit to doing something? Am I going to reach out to some people I haven't reached out to? Am I going to go find additional support? For example, I often recommend clients, especially if I'm working in like chemical dependency or addictions work, you know, I'll recommend 12-step groups or other kinds of adjunctive groups in addition to therapy, which is its own kind of community. And so, yeah, we're there to help them, but it's like, you know, the interventions that we're doing that 1 hour a week are a small fraction of like the total work that's being done.
So, and that can be so frustrating if there's barriers, you know, if there is, I used to feel that way in the schools a lot where it was like, I never get to talk to the parents. I see this child for 30 minutes. How can I build those almost like that community connection outside of the session? And sometimes there's so many barriers. But that's the, I think the beauty of, especially like the position that you're in, or when you're in like a more community-based position, you have a little bit more flexibility and the ability to reach out and really kind of target all of those things outside too.
Definitely. Although I will share also the downside of being a therapist in a more of like a niche cultural setting.
Yeah.
Which is that I have to be a little more choosy with who I work with.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be a good time to talk about dual relationships.
Ooh, yeah.
So as a music therapist, I've been like, it's been hammered into my head, no dual relationships ever. Now the counseling code of ethics is slightly more flexible on this matter, but I tend to play it safe and I think it's served me pretty well. So I don't intend to change that.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's, you know, for example, if you're a therapist in a small town and you, let's say you're, a Jewish therapist in a small town and other clients are going to seek you out because you understand what it's like to be Jewish in America. You might know them. You might see them around. And this is a huge thing. So at Mount Tabor, for example, you know, I do work with a lot of clients who I might see at events around town, right? Like, Catholic events. And I do have to be very careful and make sure that I'm kind of enough degrees removed from these clients. Like I wouldn't see anyone that I go to church with, for example, because that to me is too close. On the other hand, you know, we do have sort of an ethical mandate to serve our clients and help them. So I know that in small towns, this can be a difficulty. The reason I say small towns, you know, actually I spend one day a week, about an hour north of Denver in Longmont, which is helpful for me because I don't know anyone in Longmont, so I can just work with any of the, you know, Catholic clients up there. But my supervisee both lives and works there. And so for her, this has come up time and again where it's like, oh, like, for example, she's part of a mom's group. And can she work with one of the kids of one of her sort of like acquaintances from the mom's group, right? There's like 20 moms. Like, was that too close? So these are some, you know, interesting questions that therapists need to be aware of if they want to like really specialize in a cultural sense.
Yes. Because, and I think it just brings that circle of who you're working with smaller in a way, but then that complicates things a lot because of those, you're going to run into people, you know, whether it's, if it's a rural area and it's just space in itself, you know, it's like, there's just less people. So you're going to run into people. There's less qualified clinicians. But then even if there's something else that's connecting you like that multicultural piece, then that's so hard. And I would imagine you have to have a good Rolodex of other people to refer to.
Yeah.
In that, you know, of like, who do I trust that this person can go to because this is too close?
Definitely. Yeah. I've been lucky with it so far, but yeah, I do have a list on hand and I am always happy to refer to you if a family's looking for music therapy and that's something that, you know, if I'm too close or I can't provide that.
Yes. Same. And it really is hard because you want to serve. And then there's that secondary piece of, you know, well, it's our duty to serve. And especially like when you see a family in crisis or something like that, it's like, oh my, you know, like it just adds all of this other, these other, elements to that decision that you have to weigh. And it's really just that weighing out process.
Yeah, definitely. I think at the end of the day, that is our first mandate, right? Like as therapists, is to help, to serve, to help people.
Yes.
And we know that in particular, I mean, going back to rural areas, you know, I think about it a lot because when I'm up there in Longmont, I get clients from, you know, that are driving to Longmont from even smaller areas, more rural areas, smaller towns. And there is such a shortage of mental health services. And we see this more than ever now when we're trying to combat, like, for example, the opioid epidemic, where a lot of places where that epidemic is at its worst have a huge deficit in mental health services and lack of access.
Yes. And it's so, I feel super passionate about that because I grew up in a very rural area. Actually, one of the projects with Dr. Demanchik that we had to do in school, in human development, I think it was, I did it about rural therapists and the lack of rural therapists. Yeah. But it's really hard because I know growing up in an area like that too, like imagining myself going back to where I grew up and being a therapist there, it would be like, oh, your last name, oh, you're so-and-so's brother or you're so-and-so's cousin. And you know, it's, you're just so connected and it's so hard to remove that. But I mean, then you can have those harder conversations of like, well, what does this mean? You know, can we navigate this or is this too uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think the important thing that we want our listeners to take away is just to think about it, to be critical about it, and to, you know,
get supervision
to have to have discussions with your supervisor, with your colleagues.
Totally.
If you run into these tricky questions.
Yes, yes, that's always my first thing is like, I need to bring this up in supervision.
I need someone
else's opinion. How do I, let's navigate this. Let's tease through all of this.
That's really good modeling, Kate, of like reaching out for support. You know, we're not in this alone.
No. Oh, I'm huge on supervision. I feel like I'll never not have supervision. I think I'll just always, always want it. It's just amazing to learn from other qualified people in different niches for sure. Yeah. Well, Chris, as we wrap up, this has been so amazing to hear your passion projects from research to spirituality to child trauma. But for our listeners who may be interested in something that you're doing specifically, where is a good place to reach you?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, you can certainly, you know, people can shoot me an email if they want. I'm happy to give my email address. So you can just go ahead and find me at, I'll tell you what, I'll give my work. I'll be professional. I'll have some good boundaries.
Oh, good boundaries.
it's going to be my full name. So Christopher dot, and I got to spell my last name. It's so speaking of cultural issues, it's Polish. And I actually, this has come up a few times because there is a Polish American community in Denver, Colorado, but I feel like can't work with everyone there because I see them at the pierogi festival in the summer.
Very
so
true,
Christopher dot Wojak, W-O-J-D-A-K at Mount Tabor, T-A-B-O-R, counseling, counseling.com. Christopher dot Wojak at Mount Tabor counseling.com. Yeah, just reach out, send me an email. And of course, I'm also happy if people are in the Denver area to answer any questions in person about, you know, consultation, child trauma, psychotherapy, anything like that.
Yes, that's awesome. And it's so helpful to, which is, it's just really helpful to have that connection of, especially, you know, I think you're the first person on the podcast that we specifically have talked about spirituality. You know, we've talked a couple, you know, child trauma stuff, but, and I think you are unique with your, being a music therapist as well as an LPC. So those two, that kind of combo as well.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people.
Yeah, there's not too many of us.
There's not. There is a group on Facebook called Cross-Trained Music Therapists that we fall under that category. A lot of people there have LMFTs, LMHC, LPC, you know, all the different, some type of cross training. And actually, I might as well plug this now, but I have a panel interview in, I'm setting it up to do a panel interview of cross-trained music therapists for the podcast. So So me and Brittany Tachkoff, I think is how you say her last name. She's a hospice music therapist. And she and I kind of, we were talking about this idea and she kind of was like, what if we reach out to this group and see if people kind of want to do something? And I was like, oh, that'd be so, because I think so many people are interested in that space between bridging music therapy with some other type of adjacent field. So yeah, we're going to dig into the similar questions that we talked about, changing identity, what kind of made you go in that place. And so I'm excited for that, but soon, that'll be out.
Awesome. Exciting stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
And also go to the IAMM conference where you might meet, for example, like last time I went, I met a music therapist who is also a registered nurse.
Yes. That's so cool. That's a perfect place for that too, where you'd find those cross-trained therapists. Absolutely. Cool. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being on. And for our listeners out there, I really, really encourage you to reach out to Chris and ask him some more questions.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Kate. It was really good. We're still figuring those out. We need to get a cross-trained music therapist.
I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. I always have a really fun time talking with Chris, and I always learn so much every time I get to talk with him. So again, I encourage you to reach out, email him. He's a wealth of knowledge and has just a lot of great things that you could pick his mind about. If you're enjoying the podcast, there are a few different ways that you can support us. One of the easiest ways is to head over to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. This really, really helps other people who are looking for this resource be able to find it when they type in something in the search bar that's creative arts therapy related. So those things really, really matter, and they may seem really small, but they have a very, very big impact. Another way you can support us is through Patreon, and at Patreon, we have a bunch of different levels that you can support us. There are as little as $1 a month donations to one time a month donations, all the way up to giving whatever you feel like you can give. And whatever you decide to do at Patreon, we give a kickback. So that can include something like swag, question and answer opportunities with guests, different bonus episodes that you get access to, and a bunch of other things. So feel free to head over to Patreon. The link is in the show notes. It says support the show. So if you click on that, that will take you directly to Patreon, and you will see all those different levels that there are for our patrons. Thank you guys so much for being a part of this community, for being a listener. I'm so appreciative. We wouldn't be able to do the things that we do if you weren't out there listening. So always feel free to write in, find a way to connect and be creative.